Okay, if you guys will go ahead and pass out the handout for tonight. You're going to receive a two-sided handout, and I hope we get to it tonight. No guarantees. We're in the process. We're kind of weaving it in between other things, but we're in the process of studying a Bible survey. Just a little quick review. And our purpose is to familiarize us with the story of the Bible that is just one continuous story. And it's a story that you can tell, the one that you can learn, and you're able to share it with others. And I hope that as we go through this, you'll make yourself some notes that if the handouts prove beneficial to you, you'll keep them somewhere. And this is something that we have been studying in our Thursday community Bible class for, 2.5 years or thereabouts. And tonight we'll probably surpass where we are after almost 3 years in our Thursday class. So that'll tell you something about the detail that we're going into on Thursday. We started out talking about that there is a one way, there are a number of ways that you can tell the story of the Bible. One of the ways that to me is the easiest is there are three promises that God gave to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 that comprise a three-point outline of the whole Bible. The first one is that God told Abraham that he was going to make of his descendants a great nation of people. He, in fact, did that. If you go to Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, then you'll find out that the descendants of Abraham, that would be Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and their peers, their descendants, they're in Egypt now in Exodus chapter 1. They have become a great nation of people. That nation of people that came from Abraham is called the Jews, Israelites, children of Israel, Hebrews. All of those are synonymous terms. And so from Genesis 12 to Exodus chapter 1, verse 7 is the story of God making of Abraham's descendants a great nation of people. And then the second promise that he gave them was that he was going to give them a land. That land would be the land of Canaan. The Bible refers to it as a land that flows with milk and honey. Canaan, the promised land, all of those are terms that refer to that land. If you go from Genesis chapter 12, and then you get to Exodus chapter 1, you've got a great nation. You begin in Exodus chapter 1, you go through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua, and that's the story of God giving that nation a land. And in Joshua 21, 43 through 45, it says something to the effect that God gave unto them all the land that he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it, they dwelt in it, and there failed not any good thing that God sware unto them, but all came to pass. They got the land. God made provision for them to keep that land. And then there's only one promise that remains as a three-point outline of the Bible, and that is God promised Abraham that through his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. You've got a lot of your Bible left after the end of the book of Joshua, but from there on, it is the story of Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, will pinpoint who that seed is specifically. The Jews misunderstood that promise and believed that when God said, I will bless all nations of the earth through your seed, Abraham, that he was talking about them as a nation. But in fact, he was not talking about them as a nation. He was talking about one person. He was talking about Jesus Christ. Galatians chapter 3, verse 16 will say, whenever God spoke to Abraham, he did not say seeds, meaning many people, but unto thy seed, which is Christ. And so the rest of the Bible and history will bear out how God, through the seed of Abraham, Jesus Christ, continues to bless all nations of people. So there's a three-point outline. There are a number of other outlines that you can use, but that's one that that I'm able to use and have utilized on numerous occasions. We had a handout in about the first or second, I can't remember which lesson, of the biblical world. We had a map that we put some bodies of water, we put some countries on so that you'll be able to get a mental picture of the biblical world. From that time, even until this time, the world in which we are hearing a lot about of wars and so forth today, including the area around Jerusalem. Then we had a chronological overview of the Bible, a single sheet of paper that went down and kind of gave eras of time down the left side, and then we had some other historical, chronological events on that paper. Any of these things that you don't have, in fact, either some or all of them are on our website, but we can make hard copies additionally if you'd like to have some. And so now we have the first two promises fulfilled, the nation promise and the land promise. And we got last time, we talked somewhat about the judges. You remember who the first judge was? Oatmeal, that's right. First thing you have for breakfast when you get up in the morning. His name actually is not Oatmeal, but Othniel is your first judge. Remember who the last one was? Samuel would be your last one. And Samuel was a transition judge because actually during his lifetime he will crown two kings. And so he's the transition between the period of the judges. Once they have settled into the land, then they have been a theocracy. God ruled as a nation up to this point. But they got to the point, as you know, that they desired to have a king like the nations about them. God knew that that was going to happen. He had predicted it was going to happen. He predicted what the kings would do, and he predicted what would happen after they did it. And all of those things did, in fact, come true throughout their history. But Samuel will be the transition between the period of the judges, and the period of the judges was a time when God allowed, because of Israel's idolatry and faithlessness to him, he allowed certain ones of those nations that they had driven out to come back and to repossess the land that they had been driven away from. And we noted a cycle in the judges: sin, servitude, sorrow, and salvation. And in the form of salvation, God would send a judge. And the judge would be a deliverer, and he would lead the people. And Samuel, being the last judge, we're ready now to enter into the United Kingdom. Now they will have a physical head over them. They'll have a king from this point on in their history. And the period of the kings will be divided into the United Kingdom and the Divided Kingdom. The United Kingdom is called that because all 12 tribes were united under one king. And there were only three kings. That period only lasted about 120 years. You had the first king, Saul, David, and Solomon. And under those three kings, all of Israel, all of the Jews, all the Hebrews were under one head, one king. And everything, I start to say everything went fine. Nothing ever went very fine for them because they had a hard time following the Lord for very long. But I'd ask you last time, those of you who were interested in doing so, if you would, to read 1 Kings chapter 12, and I'd like for you to turn there. We'll spend just a little bit of time, because 1 Kings chapter 12 is going to mark a major change in the history of Israel. This will be the time when the kingdom will be divided. Most of you know the story. You've heard the story, many of you, since childhood. If you go back and lay a little bit of groundwork in 1 Kings chapter 11, there was a fellow by the name of Jeroboam who had been chosen by Solomon because of his wisdom, and he had been set over the house of Joseph, it says. And an incident happened one day when he was out in the field by himself, and a prophet came up to him, and he had a new garment on. He tore that garment off of him, and he tore it into 12 pieces, and he handed Jeroboam 10 pieces. And he said, God has said that the kingdom is about to be divided, and you're going to rule over 10 tribes of that. And this is in 1 Kings chapter 11. Well, evidently, Solomon found out about this, and he set about to kill this young man. Well, he fled to Egypt, and the Bible doesn't tell you this, but history will tell you that while he was there, he married Pharaoh's, the current Pharaoh, that would be Shishak, his sister-in-law. And so things were going pretty well for him in Egypt. And then when Solomon died and there was time for a new king to be coronated, his people, the Jews, sent for him and had him brought back. And he became a spokesman for the people. And he came along with the people, and they made a proposition to Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son, and they said, if you will lighten up on us, Solomon, by the time of his old age, had to pass some really serious taxes in order to sustain all of his riches and all the things that he had built and done. And so he really had the people taxed as a real burden in their lives. And so they came and said to him, to his son, Rehoboam, if you'll lighten up on us a little bit, we'll serve you for the rest of our lives. And so he said, give me 3 days to think about it. And he went to his friends, his peers. We'll find out a little bit later, he was 41 years old at that time. He went to his peers and he said, hey, all these old guys have come to me and they've said this to me. What do you think about it? And they said, you don't want to do that. Listen, you got to be better than your old man. Now, that's not a quote from the Bible, but that's what he said. You know, you always have to outdo the old man, right? And so you're going to have to, if you're going to bring in the kind of money that your father brought in, you're going to have to double up on these taxes. So he decided to listen to them, since that would appeal to his vanity. And he came back to them and he said, okay, I've considered it. And you think that my father was hard on you? You ain't seen nothing yet. Now that's a paraphrase also. But in essence, that's what he said to him. He said, you know, my father beat you with whips. I'm going to beat you with scorpions. Things are going to get a lot tougher around here, so you better tighten your belt up. Sound familiar? Sounds like some things that, kind of like some things that are going on today, doesn't it? With some discussion about taxes and so forth. So the people decided that they weren't going to pay tribute. He sent his men out to gather the taxes, and they came back dead. People wouldn't pay the taxes. And so they rebelled. And they chose, in verse 20 of chapter 12, they chose Jeroboam to be their king. All of them except the tribe of Judah, it said. And so they said, we're going to secede from the union. And Rehoboam said, no, you're not. So he gathered his army together, beginning in verse 21. He got his fighting men together to go out, and he was going to punish the people. And the Lord appeared to him and said, stand down, because this thing is from the Lord. This is no accident that this happened, and there's not anything you can do about it. So you just accept what you've got, and that's the way that it's going to be. And now picking up in verse 25, and I would encourage you to mark verse 25 through 33 in your Bible, because this is a really significant passage. And we'll read it together. I'm reading from the King James Version. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in Mount Ephraim and dwelt there and went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. Now here he is, he's got 10 tribes under him. And he begins to think of what problems may lie ahead. And he said, you know, when all the dust is settled, I know that people are going to tend to want to go back to Jerusalem to worship. And so he says, I've got to do something about it. Verse 27, if this people go up to do sacrifice to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of the people will turn again to their Lord, even to Rehoboam, king of Judah, and they'll kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. So he devised a plan. Whereupon the king took counsel, he made 2 calves of gold and said to them, now, notice what he did and then how he presented it to the people. You never get the straight story, do you? There was an agenda, but he's not going to tell them what the agenda is. The agenda was that he didn't want the people that he had just recently become king over to revert back to another king. And so he devises this plan. He makes two calves of gold, and he says, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Dan will be far north, Bethel will be to the south of the 10 tribes that he has. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before one, even unto Dan. And he made a house of high places, and the priests of the lowest of the people, that were not of the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 8th month, on the 15th day of the month, like the feast that's in Judah, and he offered upon the altar. And he did this in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places which he had made. So he offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised of his own heart, and ordained a feast unto the children of Israel, and he offered upon the altar the burnt incense. And this incident will come to be known historically as the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat. And that phrase will be repeated multiple times throughout the remainder of the Old Testament. And whenever it will say they followed in the ways, in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, this is the incident that it's referring back to. That he had set up an alternate place to worship. God had already established a place. Temple had been built in Jerusalem. God had put his stamp of approval on it. And he says, "I want everybody to come back here once a year and worship here and during the feast days. And this is the place where I've decided to put my name." But they split the church. And from that time on, this kingdom that will be established will never have, throughout, though it will have 19 kings from now until the time when that kingdom will be carried away into captivity, there will not be one single king who does not follow after the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Every single king from this time on will be an evil king who will not follow God. And so, that's kind of a run down in history of the divided kingdom. And you now have two kingdoms. So the United Kingdom lasted through three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. Now the kingdom is divided. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, has 10 northern tribes. The capital city of that nation, which will come to be known as Israel, will be Samaria. And you're going to have a lot of history about the Samaritans. And you're going to have a lot of history about the Samaritans at the end of the Old Testament in the intertestament period, and we'll hit on that some. And then when you come to John chapter 4, Jesus is going to see a woman at the well in Samaria. And it's going to refer all the way back to what happened here, this place of worship that will be set up. And it's going to provide a background for the scene that we find in John chapter 4 with Jesus and the Samaritan woman. And so the 10 northern tribes, Israel, capital city, Samaria. The 2 southern tribes, Judah, will have the capital city of Jerusalem. Now, on your handout, on the back side, you have 2 sides to it. One side will have some world empires. We're about to enter now, historically, the Twilight Zone. By that, I mean we're about to hit the area of the prophets, and this is a section of the Bible where most people, up to this point, most people who grew up with a religious background, going to Bible study or Sunday school or whatever you called it, are able to relate those stories, and you're able to follow along with this. But somewhere soon, we start dropping out, and we start throwing our hands up and saying, "Well, I can't understand this. I don't know what's going on. And I read this prophet, and I read this prophet, and I don't know what in the world this has to do with anything." And so I'm going to, hopefully, provide you a key that you have in your hands that's going to help make it understandable. On one side, it has the chart of the kings and the prophets of the divided kingdom. On the other side, it's going to have some world empires. And now I'd like for you to turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. And most of you know where I'm going here with this. In Daniel chapter 2, the setting here is King Nebuchadnezzar, who is the king of Babylon, has had a dream. There's been a young man, and we'll come back and pick up the history here. And I'm going to give you a little background here, and then we're going to come back and we'll pick up how Daniel came to be where he was. But there was a young Jewish boy by the name of Daniel who had been carried away captive into Babylonia. And he had proven himself to be a really, really good student. So much so that he had risen in this powerful world empire. And God had given him a number of really special talents, but the talent that stood out at this point in his life was he had the ability to interpret dreams. And he had demonstrated that on more than one occasion. And on this occasion, Daniel chapter 2, the greatest king that ever lived up to that time in history, King Nebuchadnezzar, had a dream. And he couldn't find anybody to interpret that dream. You remember the story. All the young people remember that story. And he had issued a command that all of the wise people were going to be killed because nobody could tell him. And he was having this recurring dream, and it was really bothering him. And so Daniel heard that all the wise men were going to be killed, and he heard it because he was going to be one of them. And so he went and asked for a little bit of time. And he got the time, and he came to the king, and he had his friends, and they had a prayer session. And God revealed the dream to him, an interpretation of it. And he came to the king, and he said, King, give me the opportunity to tell you what your dream is and tell you what the meaning of it is. And so he gave him some time. He came back to him, and he said, King, here's the dream that you had. You dreamed of this statue, this 90-foot-high statue that was made of different materials, and here's what it means. The head and the breast were made of gold, or the head was made of gold, the breast was made of silver, and then you had the lower part made of bronze, and then you had the last part that was made of iron, and then the toes and the feet were made of iron and clay. And this 90-foot statue, and he kept having that same dream over and over. And so he knew there must be some special meaning to it, but he didn't know what it was. And he said, so you can interpret my dream. And he said, no, sir, I can't. But I serve a God who can. And so he began to interpret the dream. He said, thou, O Nebuchadnezzar, art this head of gold. And he proceeds at that point to tell him that each one of those different materials that makes up that statue of that 90-foot-high man represents a world empire that is going to come. Now, there's one part that's missing here. The first empire is missing, Assyria. And it's missing because it's already come and gone. Now, we're into the Babylonian. If you look on the back, you'll have Assyria, Babylonia, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Five world empires. And I've also given you on the right-hand side their capital city. And the reason that I've done that is particularly in the case of a couple of them, not so much the last two, but in the case of about three of those, quite often when the Bible wants to talk about the Assyrian Empire, it will talk about Nineveh because that's the capital city of that empire. And so whenever it talks about Nineveh, quite often it's talking about the empire as a whole. Did I put Syria on that map? Okay, well, I did? Somebody's saying yeah and somebody's saying no. Is Syria on there? Okay, Syria technically is not a world power. But Syria, I put it on there because that's Israel's northern neighbor. And they're constantly at war with one another. They're fighting against one another. And the capital city of Syria is a city that you will hear quite frequently in the Old Testament, Damascus. And so whenever we talk about Damascus, it's talking about the capital city of Syria, who's the northern neighbor of Israel. And he will proceed and he'll say, King, you are the head. So the first empire was Babylon. He said, after you will arise another empire that will be inferior to you. And that would be the Persian Empire. And he says, after it will be yet another one that will be the Grecian Empire. The Old Testament will come to a close when the Medes and the Persians are the world empire. And we'll get there and we'll talk about what's happening with the Jews during that time. When the New Testament opens, what world empire is in control? Rome is, right? And so between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament, there is a world empire that rises and falls. And that would be Greece. And so everything that you know about the Greeks, Alexander, Philip of Macedon, and even the science, the fathers of modern medicine and sciences and different things quite often are Greeks. And so during that 400-year period of time between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament, you have the history, the world history of the Greeks and philosophy and different things that came from those people. And then he will, and one of the primary reasons for this whole scene here in Daniel chapter 2 is he will talk about in the days of the kings of this very last empire, and that would be the Roman Empire. And he said, you'll notice, he said, I know that you noticed in your vision that the feet and the toes of this image were made partly of iron and partly of clay. Now, what do you know about iron and clay? You know the same thing that you do about oil and water. They don't mix. And so it can't be very strong. Iron is extremely strong. So there was a part of that empire that was really strong, and then there were some things that were woven within that empire that were really, really weak. And he said, and while you watched, he said, you saw a rock cut out of a mountain without hands. And that rock hit that image on its feet, and the image collapsed. And the wind came and blew it away. And he said, and while you watched, that rock grew, and it became extremely large and filled the whole earth. He said, during the days of these kings, those Roman kings, the God of heaven's going to set up an empire. We've been looking at empires that were comprised of men. But during the days of the Roman kings, the God of heaven's going to set up an empire. And he said, and it'll never fall. It will never be left to another people. All of these other empires have risen and fallen. Other people have come in and taken over them. He said, but not this empire. It's going to last forever. Now, that's a projection all the way to Acts chapter 2, where the Lord set up his kingdom during the days of Rome, and that would be the church. And it still exists to this very day today. And so, as we get into this section here, the divided kingdom, then you have to bring in some additional information. And that additional information, we've projected it way on down now, but let's come back to Assyria, Babylonia, Medo-Persia. Those three world empires will provide a backdrop for the prophets. All the prophets will fall within that time period, with the possible exception of one or two really early ones that came before Assyria, one of which we don't really know for sure when to date it. But look at your kings and prophets chart. If you would, put that on our overhead for us here, and we'll introduce this at least, and then we'll pick back up with this again, Lord willing, in another lesson soon to come. You'll notice on the chart here, and by the way, I don't know how to tell you how valuable this chart is to me. I ran across this chart, and I think yours has from Cincinnati Press, College Press, or something down at the bottom of it where it came from. It came out of a book, Old Testament History, by William Smith. It's a College Press book. I don't know if it's still in print or if it's not. But this chart right here, in my opinion, is one of the most valuable pieces of information that I have ever been able to get my hands on in my whole life. I have a small chart about that big, this same chart that's made smaller, taped in the front of all my Bibles. And I hope to be able to explain to you why and some of the value of the chart. You'll notice up here at the top, we start out, I punched the wrong button here. Let me get down here. Can I go back with that thing? Yeah. You'll notice up at the top, right up here, you have kings of Israel and prophets, kings of Judah and prophets. And this is where the kingdom is divided. We talked a little bit about Jeroboam and Rehoboam. Can y'all see this over here? Okay. And you'll have 19 kings in Israel, and you'll have 19 kings in Judah. You'll notice up here, this little edge looks like it's torn, and this little edge looks like it's torn. What that means is that should be one long chart, okay? But it's torn in half where Israel came to an end right here. Israel is going to go from about 930 to 720. And then it's going to come to an end. And what I want to show you now, and I'll make a recommendation to you, that you can doctor up your chart as much as you like. And if you need another one and mess up, well, I'll give you another one. But let me show you what I did to my chart. We talked about the world empires, Assyria, and then Babylonia, and then Medo-Persia. And at these points, and you'll notice the bottom chart only continues with Judah. You know why, right? Because Israel doesn't exist at that point. They've been carried away captive right here by the Assyrians. And they'll never be heard from again. They're assimilated among the nations. Some people have called them the 10 lost tribes. They didn't get lost. They came to an end. God ended that kingdom. And it was the Assyrians who came and carried them away captive. And then after Assyria, and remember in Daniel's dream, whenever he interpreted that dream, he said, "Thou, O king," right here, that would be in Babylonia, "you're this head of gold. And after you will come another empire that will be inferior to you. That will be the Medes and the Persians." And there's an interesting thing, and I'll give you a few dates, okay? I'm not big on dates, and the reason I'm not is because I can't remember them myself, okay? But I'll give you three or four dates that you can write on the top of your chart right here and see what happened that Assyria came to be known as a world power. It was something that happened right here. And there's a story behind it, and it's a Bible story behind it. And then right here in 722 is when Israel came to an end. You see the kingdom ends right there in 722. And it will be gone. And then whenever Assyria falls, Babylonia will come on the scene. Whenever Babylon falls, then the Medes and the Persians will come on the scene. The divided kingdom began in 1 Kings chapter 12. We talked about. We read that section, the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. And I mentioned a little bit, even though Syria is not considered a world power, there was a constant battle between Israel, the northern kingdom, and Syria. Syria got progressively stronger until Syria and Israel decided, the king of Israel and the king of Syria, Rezin was the king of Syria, and Isaiah will have something to say about this. They joined forces because they got mad at Judah, and they decided they were going to go down and take all of Judah's land. And this is Syria now, not Assyria. Syria and Assyria are two different countries. Syria will be the northern neighbor of Israel. They joined with Israel to come down and whip Judah and teach him a lesson. Well, in desperation, the king of Judah was terrified, and so he called for some help. And guess who he called? He called Assyria. And God told him not to. The prophet Isaiah told him not to. But he was so terrified, he did anyway. And he said, the razor that you call is going to shave your own head. And so Assyria came, and they captured right here. Whoop, I don't know what I did. Right here. They captured Damascus. Damascus is the capital city of what? Syria. The fact that Judah called Assyria to come help them provided the opportunity for Assyria to become a world power. The Assyrians were among the most cruel people that there have ever existed. They loved to skin their captives alive. They learned how to keep them alive as long as they possibly could and torture them as horrendously and horrifically as they possibly could. And there was purpose behind this. I mean, you may not like the purpose, but the purpose was you didn't want to fight those folks. You surely didn't want to be taken captive. And so they put fear in people. And they were famous after they had done all the things that they could to their captives, and finally the captives would die, then they would cut their heads off and put stakes on around their city walls at 45-degree angles, and they would stick thousands of heads of their enemies on those stakes all the way around the walls of their cities. Now stop and think about what that would mean if you were an army that was going to come and fight against an Assyrian city. How would your heart feel when you looked up there and there were just heads all over those walls in various states of disrepair? Can you imagine how you would feel and how many armies would say, you know what? I don't think it's so important that we take that city. And so the Assyrians were incredibly, incredibly cruel people, but they were extremely powerful also. And so that empire will last until Babylonia comes on the scene, and then the greatest king, King Nebuchadnezzar, was extremely powerful. Each one of these civilizations will become a little bit more civil. The Babylonians, they were cruel also, but they weren't as bad as the Assyrians. And they had, the Assyrians didn't particularly have a lot of appreciation for beauty. The Babylonians, on the other hand, built things like the Hanging Gardens. Beautiful, beautiful places. And so they became a little more civilized. You come on down to the Medes and the Persians and at the end, and then you move on to the Greeks, and the Greeks were quite civilized, right? And then you come to the Romans, and they were, you know, they were pretty civilized, but they had some ruthlessness about them also. So we keep coming on down to these. At this point, I've got to stop, and I guess I'm probably always there and just going to find the difficulty in finding a place to stop. But let me just stop right here. We've got, let's stop here so we have a place to pick up next time. These 19 kings of Israel, let's stop where this comes to an end. And I want to point out, let me point out one more thing just to show you something of the value of this chart. And I'm going to punch this again. You'll notice where just where there is about to be a change in the world empire, right here, right up there, a little bit less right here, but some right here. You notice clusters of prophets right here. You see, these are the kings up here. These are the prophets right here. You notice you got several prophets that are clustered right around these transition periods. Let me tell you a little interesting thing. Before you ever, if you don't know anything about what Isaiah or Micah or Zephaniah or Nahum or Habakkuk, if you don't know anything about what they're prophesying about, you can look at this chart and you can almost know what they're going to be prophesying about. You know what these prophets are going to be prophesying about? That this kingdom's about to fall and this one's coming on. And the same thing there, the same thing here. That's what they're going to be prophesying about. And it's going to give you, provide you a historical background to understand those prophets that perhaps you've never had before. And if you'll keep that chart and you want to find out something about Nahum, then before you even read it, go and look and see where he's positioned. See what's about to happen historically, and you're going to have a really good idea about what he's going to be prophesying about. There's going to be a lot of other advantages that I'll try to demonstrate to you with this chart, and hopefully it'll become valuable to you also and be beneficial in your study. And if you would like it, and if there's enough demand, we'll shrink some of them down so you can take one in the front of your Bible. So if you'd like to have that, then you can let me know or call the church office or something, and we'll make some smaller ones. I'll give you some dates right here and what happened. They're really pretty simple when we, next time, Lord willing. And you'll be able to put those dates right here and know what happened when these kingdoms, one fell and another one rises. And those dates will be pretty important historically. In all of this, one of the things that just keeps coming back over and over and over and over again is the lesson that the Lord told Daniel. He said, it's the God of heaven who sets up kingdoms and tears down kingdoms. And I happen to believe that he still does. I believe God's still in control. And whenever a nation, righteousness is a blessing to every nation. Sin is a reproach. Nations, early, generally in their history, tend to be moral. The longer that they exist and the more prosperity that a nation enjoys, the further and further they get away from God. It looks like someday we could learn something. But we can't, can we? We can't. We have to follow the same path over and over and over again. And you can read things like Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, and it's really, really frightening about the things that were happening just before the collapse of the Roman Empire. And you look around us, and it's really, really frightening to see the things that are happening. But in all this, the beauty is, if you're a Christian, you're going to turn out well in the end anyway. You can be a Christian regardless of what world empire is doing what, whether it's Russia, or whether it's Babylonia, or whether it's China, or whether it's Brazil, or whether it's the United States of America. God's word passes around the globe like a big old magnet, and it pulls out the people who will respond to it. It doesn't matter. You can be a Christian under any form of government. Some of them, it's a lot more pleasant than others. But you can be a Christian under any form of government. And we need to teach our children that. You know, our children, these young people, I thought a lot about how difficult and unsure and uncertain things were whenever in the 60s when I was growing up as a kid. And I've always kind of brought that out. And more recently, I've begun to think about how uncertain these young people's life is that they're growing up in their world. I mean, there's so much stuff going on today. I mean, we dropped some bombs on Syria yesterday. And it's not like we're not extended, are we? Who knows? But I know it's a difficult time. And it's a difficult time to be a young person when you don't have the history. You don't bring with you, having lived through enough circumstances, that you know for sure yourself that God's in control and everything is going to be all right if you're a Christian. If you're not a Christian, you don't have any hope. You're just subject to the whims of this world. But if you are a Christian, your future's secure. And these empires come and they go. And they will as long as the world stands. But if you're a Christian, your future's in God's hands. And if you're not, it's not. It is in God's hands, but you've not chosen to serve Him. And your future is not secure with Him. And you can change that tonight if you want to. While we stand and sing, won't you come?